take part in the Christmas card stream. Now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with Jack Maninoff from the Galler Project, and he's going to talk about that and the need for it and the climate of internet censorship and control that seems to be developing as we speak. Now, obviously, this is a well-worn topic, but it is moving into a new phase, and I think it's right for us to talk about that. So, Jack Maninoff, hello and welcome to Millennial. I should say this is another debut for this year. Could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. Hello, Mr. Woes. I go by Jack Maninoff, or Jack, in online circles, although I'm not exactly an anonymous person. It's Jack's nickname for a long time as well. I'm a Canadian expat. I have worked in IT a lot over my career. I have a background in engineering, physics. My doctorate is computational chemistry, essentially. So lots of time on the computer. And I kind of took a long circuitous path to sort of join these spheres. Starting back in the mid-2000s, I would have considered myself a green more than anything else. That was pretty hot at the time. Inconvenient Truth had come out recently. And a lot of the, you know, arguments when they're presented at a base level, you know, sound convincing. But I came across a very influential writer for myself as part of, I was into like the peak oil sphere. This was kind of a blogosphere thing shortly before 2008. And I came across this fellow named John Michael Greer, who was a Burkean conservative, but also an esotericist. And he's an arch-druid. He's a practicing druid. So he kind of ticks a lot of boxes for heterodox thought. And I found his writing and those of the people that he interacted with very convincing. Peak oil kind of went away shortly after 2008. That was, you know, that was the new crisis that everyone was excited about. And also like big zero interest money printing after 2008 sort of gave rise to the fracking boom, the shale oil boom in the U.S. So peak oil looked like it was put away. The U.S., for example, U.S. oil production reached all-time highs and things like that. But a lot of the lessons there stayed with me, and, you know, I stayed around. You know, mostly I was interested in heterodox thought because, you know, a lot of people, nothing makes sense if you just watch the news at face value. And I eventually, you know, watched as the alt-right and the distant right / the e-right, whatever the heck it calls itself now, sort of came into being. And I fell in with, I don't know, I'm a big appreciator of like the elite theory school of the of the e-right, let's say, and found a lot of those content creators. And decided once I saw Beowulf go public that this was an organization that looked serious enough, that was, you know, not, there was a lot of interesting organizations that came and went during the alt-right days, let's say, and you know, maybe weren't appropriate for everyone to get in involved in. But Beowulf came along, and I've been a member of Beowulf for, forget if it's two and a half years or 3.5 years at this point. And so when I joined Beowulf, my tech background fit a need that they had. They basically had a lot of projects that they were either currently running or wanted to roll out that need to be hosted somewhere. And, you know, a lot of people in Beowulf or projects in Beowulf are located in the UK or touch on the UK at some point. And, you know, we've seen over the past decade or so the online environment in the UK has progressed, let's say. And it's become very difficult. And I mean, you're no stranger to that, the situation.
Certainly not. People talk now about the Wild West of the internet in the second half of the 90s and first half of the 2000s, maybe actually, throughout the 2000s and then the start of the 2010s. And I think, from the mid-2000s, you had the social media giants, the platforms that emerged, Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And I think that was the start of that transformation. But the censorship as such didn't start. It's almost like the huge platforms had to form first, attract all these people, massive, massive numbers of people, away from all the tiny little websites that had been there before. The social media giants had to form first so that censorship could be implemented. And that's what happened. I mean, I don't know if it could have happened without the giants, but that is the way it played out. And so those are the vectors through which censorship is implemented, whether it's autonomous on the part of those platforms or requested of them by national governments. And I think both have been happening at once. What is your perspective of what I've just said? This... Because as people often say, in the early days, you could say anything on YouTube and you could say anything on Twitter. Of course, the slogan of YouTube was broadcast yourself. And I think they got rid of that around 2015, 16. and even the name YouTube, it lends itself to that interpretation that it's you, it's whatever you want and your channel is your thing. And all of that, certainly if you're in politics or anything controversial, that attitude was completely evaporated. But I don't need to go through that. I've talked about this umpteen times. So give your perspective on all of this and up to the present day. But before we talk about what's coming and the present laws that have come in, go through from 2000 to 2022.
Sure. So, I mean, we should never forget that what became the internet started as a U.S. military project to build a data connectivity system that would survive a nuclear war. So by its very nature, it is decentralized. There are multiple routes between hosts. And that's really how the early internet developed. I mean, I remember, I think I first was sending an email on the internet, I want to say like 96 or 95 or something like that. You couldn't actually get on the internet yet, but I had a BBS that had some kind of connection to the internet. And this was really cool. I mean, I really got into internet technology as a result of this. Whereas, you know, I remember the internet before Facebook and things like that, but what clearly happened was a gigantic amount of money was funneled into internet technology. Now, this started before the dot-com bubble, so this was late 90s still. And then the dot-com bubble burst, and there was some shakeout, and basically we were left with many of the big players that we're familiar with today, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and they... By being in that large position, they were basically the largest and could therefore capture the most of the internet. Now, what was really interesting is back in those days, particularly Google was still in principle committed to like open protocols on the internet. So if you remember the early internet as well, you remember there was like 10 different instant messaging platforms that you used to be on, and you had like multi-messengers that, you know, could connect to more than one of them, and this network would kick that off and blah, blah, blah. And Google actually was really heavily involved in something called XMPP, which was supposed to be, you know, like email for instant messaging, where anyone could send messages between any providers. And then that just sort of disappeared. I mean, XMPP still exists, but nobody talks about it really anymore. And certainly all of these large providers, you know, at some point they decided to shift away from open technologies, and instead they decided to build a lot of walled gardens on the internet. And that's where we find ourselves today.
Well, I can give two things. I've said this before, but not for quite a long time. Obviously, Google's original slogan was "Don't be evil," and they presented themselves as sort of quirky, wacky, slightly wacky company that was a bit offbeat and got it, understood. You know, we're not staid, we're not boring, we're not Microsoft. We are nerds, but we're real people. That kind of attitude. And certainly we're harmless, we're benign. We like things, we like life, we're interested in things. We want open, we want to hear things, we want to experience things. That was the general attitude of Google. And I remember around about 2012, 2013, there was I think it was Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, was doing a speech conference, and he said, We are approaching a point at which the internet will be uncensorable, like censorship will be impossible on the internet. And he was saying that as a good thing. He was excited by that prospect. And of course, there was also, you'll remember this, there was a phrase that would drift around in the 2000s, which was something like the internet
takes censorship, you know, the one, damage and routes around it.
Exactly. It perceives censorship as damage and routes around it. And that was a general idea. It was just a given that, there's a funny message that was posted from 1997 that people will have seen. A guy called, what was his name? I think it was, hold on a minute, I'll find it. I've got it here. Mifflin Devon, and he was posting in 97 about the Nintendo 64, and he uses very flowery language. And the point is, the only point of bringing that up is to show that was the atmosphere on the internet then. It was this sense that you can say anything. Yeah, it's a completely free space. It's not real life, and it's not the meat space, and it's not constrained by the same rules that govern meat space and ordinary social interaction. And actually, most of the time that was fine. Most of the time that wasn't gross or hurtful or malicious. It was just because most people are sensible. The vast majority of people don't want to post, you know, photos of, dead babies or something terrible like that. So that spirit of openness definitely did characterize the internet for the first, I would say, 10 years. And then it got a bit more formal with the giants. And then you've got Sergey Brin saying that around 2012. And then Trump and Brexit. And I think that was when all of this changed and changed rapidly and radically. Do you want to take that up?
Sure. So I think there's a few factors that sort of went into it. One, you can look at the systemic factor, which is that all these tech giants were big publicly traded companies that, you know, need to make money off this user base. And the experience of the 2000s was that, okay, people are going online in droves, they're using it, like, interactions with the internet are going up, up, up. but very few people are willing to pay for things. So so much of the early internet had been, you know, everything was free love, you know, we're the wild hackers, which, I mean, is fine. But when large public companies go in and try to monetize that space, they're left with few ways to monetize their audience, per se. And I mean, that's something that, you know, influencers are still dealing with to this day. So
don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, to me, that's one of the reasons why these systems became closed, is because, you know, the value that could be extracted from the audience was in having them captive. And you can see that now. You'll see infographics every once in a while, like, what's the biggest chat platform by country? And that's what they've done. They've diced up the world, and like, WhatsApp is the biggest in this country, Facebook Messenger is in the next, and things like that. So, you know, nobody wants to have, I'm sure they would love to have monopoly control over everyone, but, you know, it's okay to be part of an oligopoly that has a captive audience, and, you know, you're part of the big two or three. So there was that. And then I would also say that if you remember back to the 90s was sort of like the first wave of PC culture, and then that kind of went away again during those nice days of the internet that we were reminiscing about. And then during, you know, towards the end of the Obama administration, suddenly PC came back again in its new form, what we call woke. And so suddenly, yeah, an open internet for saying whatever you want was politically unfavorable. And, you know, and then with the rise of Trump, then obviously there were interests that were very interested in controlling what people were saying about him and promoting his messages and things like that. And, you know, then he comes into power, and then you saw like the big ban waves starting, I don't know, 2017, 2018, things like that. And they could get away with it at that point because so much of the internet audience was captive. They were held in these, you know, in these silos. And, you know, like you could always go post a video on your own website, but, you know, who's going to find it? You're taken out of Google search algorithm. Who's going to be recommended it? You know, you're not being popped up on the top of anyone's feed or shared easily. So they really got a stranglehold on, you know, not the base layer of the internet, but like the user interaction layer. And that's something that, you know, like, so people got kicked off of YouTube and BitChute started and Rumble started and things like that. I mean, the solution to that problem isn't to build a new walled garden to try to corral people over into, because, you know, the same sorts of pressures will apply to whoever operates these new sites. And so that's kind of one of the goals behind Gjallar and later projects that will come online with Beowulf Foundation, where, you know, like, we kind of need to get the social aspects of the internet back. And there's lots of technical ways you can do that, but basically it involves taking servers back and hosting our own content and being able to federate, you know, between people. So, you know, you wouldn't use Facebook, you'd use woz.com, which would be running an app that basically looks like Facebook and plugs into other people's websites and gives you feeds or things like that. So, and all we right. can talk about that more, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I should say, I meant to say this at the beginning, it's only thanks to the chaotic nature of scheduling, it's just an accident that the two Beowulf projects have ended up appearing consecutively. I didn't plan this. It's just the way it shook out. So if anyone's wondering about that, it's just sheer coincidence. But
refer to
anyway,
earlier stream, yeah, for what they will.
Yes, yeah, so will things, yeah. So where do we, I suppose we should now talk about the current situation, just to prepare people for what you believe is coming. Other people, I had a guest on last night, Cameron McGregor, who thinks that it's all about to fall apart. And so there's not much to be worried about. But I think you have a very different perspective, and that all of this surveillance and control and censorship is going to get even more ramified than it already is. So you take us away with.
Sure. So yeah, I don't really have this skit like a month by month year in review. January this happened, February that happened, but I've kind of broken things down by country. And what I would say is we're seeing it now in 2025, but a lot of efforts that had been put into place by governments and various other actors during the COVID period, laws related to fake news and things like that, we're starting to see that come to fruition now. And the aggressiveness of national governments to clamp down on undesirable speech online has taken a pretty sharp, I mean, it's apparent to us now as it starts to come into effect, but it's taken a pretty sharp increase. And one thing I would start us off with is actually something that happened last year in August when Pavel Durov, the CEO, or I think he was the CEO of Telegram, was essentially coaxed into France with some kind of offer to meet someone, do something, and then arrested, and basically the French government sat on him for a few weeks. And I think by the end of September, Telegram had changed their terms of service, saying, yes, we, you know, they had previously had a hard stance of like, we don't really cooperate with law enforcement requests. And by the end of September 2024, they did. And that was a pretty overt use of, let's say, hard state power to make a pretty significant change, I think, to the like social media ecosystem. Because, you know, Telegram for a long time, you know, it was, I don't know if they were based in Russia specifically, but, you know, they got away sort of with flouting the conventions that were set down in 2018 or so by the YouTubes and the Twitters and so on, by being based in Russia. But of course, Russia is, you know, person non grata at the moment. So maybe that's why they held out a little longer. But yeah, when you sit on the CEO of the company, then you can get these sorts of changes. So I would say that sets us over to a lot of issues, a lot of things that you guys have seen in the UK starting this year. And actually, it's surprising because during COVID, for example, a lot of the online tougher online measures you were seeing in like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the kind of the periphery of the Anglosphere. Whereas this year, it seems that it's really the UK that's leading the charge on this stuff. So although it was passed in 2023, I believe, the Online Safety Act came into force this year. And quickly you saw X move to introduce age verification. And, you know, I'm currently based in Turkey, so I'm not even in an EU country. And I started getting, you know, like, oh, we need to verify your age to see this. And like, this law isn't mine. But, you know, because, I mean, that might give you a preview of where you can expect these laws to roll out in the future, which is everywhere, or at least everywhere in the West, let's say. And there's lots of arguments about, you know, why this is necessary. I don't remember exactly when it passed, but the EU Digital Services Act is used as the legal force behind a lot of the recent changes that have been made to online services as well. So it's not happening in any one country, but I would say that the Online Safety Act kicking in is really, you know, like, I think it was within a week that X was doing age verification. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, and there's a similar act in Australia. I think it's got the same name. And then there's the EU. And I believe that a similar act is actually going through Congress just now in America, which is amazing because J.D. Vance is, and Trump, both of them have personally said that they don't like censorship, they don't like what Britain's doing, and yet it seems to be going on in their own country under their nose, and they're not even aware of it. Or, I don't know, they're not, as far as I know, they're not opposing it. So, and of course, the pretext for this is to protect kids. It's always this, won't someone think of the kids? And I could understand that. Porn sites, I think it's probably quite right that they've got age verification to protect kids from seeing stuff, although I don't think it will actually have that desired effect. But nonetheless, I can understand it. Substack essays. I've had Substack essays which are now behind an age verification wall. It's happened with quite a few of my essays already. This started about 2-3 weeks ago. Morgoth, some of his essays are behind it as well. There's nothing you can do about it, and I think you can appeal it, but I mean, everyone's just guessing at this stage, and Substack could be endangering themselves by taking something out from behind that wall. And it seems to be quite arbitrary. And of course, that's the nature of these laws. They incentivize providers, platforms, to be more censorious than they probably have to be because they don't know exactly where the line is drawn. So they have to be overly careful. And I think that's exactly the goal. I think that's exactly the purpose of this kind of law, and so it's you can see this freezing effect, and it's interesting because at first I think the social media platforms themselves were doing this and were motivated to do this stuff, censoring people, deplatforming, deboosting, but now the national governments, I think for whatever reason, I think those platforms stopped doing that around about 22, 23. And I think they felt that they'd maybe done as much as they wanted to do. They'd broken the back of the politics on YouTube, for example. It was just decimated. There are still people there, but there's no ecosystem anymore. And and the channels that are still there don't get boosted anymore. So I think they maybe had done as much as they wanted to do, but I also think it was becoming embarrassing for them. It was becoming too much of a known thing that they were doing this, especially because Trump started talking about it finally. And so then it switched over to the national governments. They took over this and started mandating. So then the social media platforms can say, well, look, it's not our choice. We don't want to do this, but we've got to do this because the governments are forcing it. And then you get this leak of effect where, and J.D. Vance has talked about this, that the British law is affecting American companies and presumably also American consumers, the public. And as you saw in Turkey, a British law somehow affects you in Turkey. Because, I mean, that is sort of because of the very nature of the internet. I mean, we're in a very weird situation because of the internet, because of the nature of it. Let's say that I went to Germany and said something on Twitter that was illegal in Britain, but not in Germany. And then I came back to Britain. Would I be breaking the law from the moment I landed because my tweet is up? No one knows. I'm still purveying it to the public, even though I didn't post it. I didn't tweet it in Germany, in Britain. So who knows? This is the weird thing. And then, of course, you've got the audience, the people who will actually see that tweet. Some of them will be in countries where that tweet is legal and others will be in countries where it's illegal. So do those countries, are they able to prosecute me from afar? Because I've said something that's going out in their country and is illegal there, even though I wasn't there. These questions haven't been answered yet, and there aren't any satisfactory answers to it. And it's all sort of absurd because we've done without these laws for all the time the internet's been around. So that, like, as a public thing, that's 30 years. We've never needed this stuff before. But now that it's here, for whatever reasons, it has all sorts of strange effects that might not even be guessed at when these laws are being written, but I think are desired by the lawmakers because it just is a general chilling effect.
Yeah, so to build on a couple of points that you made, so I think one of the things that's changed in recent years is, and it should stem from efforts within the EU to try to have economic warfare against the US because, you know, most tech giants are based in the US and the EU wants to have some of those. And so the new tool that governments have found is like the ability to fine international companies based on like percentages of their worldwide gross. And so that seems to be, that's what's being put in all these laws now, is that, you know, we will fine you, you know, $50 million for, or 2% of your worldwide gross if you break our age restriction law or things like that. And I don't know why that wasn't considered a possibility before, but it could be just, yeah, we're entering a more, you know, since Trump and increasing tariffs and things like that, we're entering an era where that kind of outright digital economic warfare is now on the table. And so, you know, us little peons down here get to suffer the consequences as a result. And an interesting case of that was, for example, was it Kiwi Farms was presented with a like $10,000 or £10,000 a day fine by the UK government and basically told block the UK or we will fine you this. And I don't know where that case is or whether fines have actually been levied or whatnot, but that's even showing that, you know, the national governments are willing to go after someone that isn't the huge tech giants. You know, like they're not just looking for money, they are looking for cutting the speech off. And so one other interesting point that I had on the UK this year is that the UK also served Apple, I think it was in April, a what's called a secret or a technical capability notice, which I'm reading my notes here, is something under the 2016 Investigatory Powers Act. And basically, this secret notice was served to Apple, and they were demanding that Apple modify the encryption used in the iCloud service in order to grant law enforcement access to encrypted data of the users. And Apple responded to this by disabling their highest level encryption feature in the UK, which the UK government later withdrew this capability notice, as far as I understand, but Apple to this day still does not give you what they call advanced data protection, which is essentially encryption of your emails, texts, photos, using encryption that Apple cannot turn over the keys to the UK government. So this kind of extends out to a theme that we can talk about as well in the EU, which is as part of monitoring for exploitive child pornography, essentially, and whatnot. The EU chat control is a bill or something that's making its way through the EU regulation process. And the goal of EU chat control is that technology providers will provide automatic scanning of all of your messages, photos, and files, including those that are encrypted, in order to search for contraband materials, whether that's child pornography or it can go anywhere, revenge porn, terrorist threats, you know, whatever is deemed as illegal speech in this or that EU country. And this has been like a fight that people on the internet have been fighting for a long time, which is, I mean, this was a thing back in like the night under Clinton, was attempts by governments to introduce backdoors into encryption in order to do this or that or save the children or something like that. And once one of these laws passes somewhere, and I believe there is a law in the book on the books in Australia that requires providers to do this, basically encryption becomes, you know, something that, okay, like, it stops Joe Blow from intercepting traffic or something like that, but all intelligence agencies, all police agencies should have access to basically everything you do online. And the automatic scanning aspect is particularly pernicious because it basically implies that there should be some sort of AI model running on your device, checking your photos in real time that, you know, that you're being a good boy. And I mean, I can make the argument later that, you know, they're trying, but I think a lot of this will just backfire and, you know, push people off of these tech providers because they don't want to participate in this. But I don't know, like the masses can be convinced of just about anything. So maybe they can be convinced that they should have basically a warrantless wiretap running on their cell phone 24/7. But I don't know if you want
to. It's amazing to think of it. I mean, and as you say, I think that a lot of people will just need to be told this is to stop child porn, and they'll go along with it because nobody approves of child porn. I mean, it's obviously a dreadful thing. And I think that's all you'll probably need to say to the masses, and they'll just buy it. All of the political stuff they won't have any interest in. But then again, the petition against digital ID in Britain did get 3 million signatures. That's a huge number for Britain. But of course, then it didn't have any effect anyway. 3 million people, it just didn't matter. It just didn't matter to the organized minority.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these, as I say, like, these are plans that, you know, it's laws that were passed multiple years ago that are just coming into force now. And so that's kind of, you know, for us to shout stop at this moving train, it's a little too late. I mean, you're going to have to fight it in the courts or something, I guess. But because a lot of this stuff is already been decided, and, you know, you're just being informed about this now as the public, which brings me, I would say, to my last UK related topic, which is the topic of digital ID. So we've been hearing about digital ID, and it's coming, it's not coming, it's going to be like this, it's going to be like that. And then surprise, it's announced by Keir Starmer that I don't know when exactly he plans to bring it.
I think it was around September, August, September, I think it was, around then.
No, I mean, when he plans for it to become mandatory. Like, he's announced it will happen, but
yeah,
it should come in by the end of his mandate, I suppose.
That was it. He said by the end of this parliament, which would be 2029, I guess.
Right. And, you know, this is obviously something that's been, you know, like, the technology stack has been in the works for a number of years. There are countries where this technology has been being trialed. So you can look at African countries. There's a lot of, like, homegrown digital ID systems in, like, the Far East, Asia. And, I mean, Estonia is always lauded as, oh, they were the first to have a really good digital ID system, and look, everything's great there. But the devil's in the details with digital ID. So I think there's a couple of factors going on here. So digital ID is obviously something that can be used for censorship, right? Like, the big mantra during the COVID era was that there's fake news, and fake news is bad, and, you know, we can't have people spreading rumors online. And to a certain degree, I'm sympathetic to that argument. Like, you know, if you're just going to, let's say on this level, like if you're going to be putting out messages saying like, there's an earthquake in this city right now, in with an account claiming to be a national government or like an emergency response authority or something like that, you know, like there does need to be some way to validate that messages come from who they say they come from. But on the flip side, and especially when you mix it with the age verification requirements that are coming in, what it essentially means is that anonymous and pseudonymous speech on the internet becomes a non-thing. And why is that? Well, how do you prove a negative? How do you prove you are over the age of 16 or 18 or whatever it is you need to be on a website? Well, you have to show some pony up some ID, right? And if we're going to roll this out everywhere, then, and it's electronic, well, it better be digital ID, hadn't it? So there's that aspect of it. But I think it's also being pushed a little bit because of, I'm not really certain how much, let's say, the elites were expecting generative AI to become such a thing so quickly. I think they might have been a little bit surprised by it. So, and that will become really important. I think we're going to see this issue play out over the next 5-10 years or so, just because all of the online platforms are going to have to adapt to the fact that, you know, like, am I really talking to millennial wolves right now, or am I talking to an AI impersonation of them? And this is something, you know, like, there's talk online the last few years about dead internet theory, where, you know, like, the whole internet will just become full of spam, full of AI generated text, you know, full of third worlders you don't like, you know, whatever it is, and all of the activity that was previously out on the open internet will have to look inwards and move into closed circles where you can validate who it is you're actually talking to, is it someone you trust, la la la, to build a reputation system within the closed group. And I mean, we really have seen this since X monetization started. Was it late last year or early this year that suddenly, like, a lot of inauthentic or pure slop accounts were coming up and they were chasing that money and claiming everything and under the sun? And so digital ID will have to play some sort of role in building identity back on the internet. Like, in the early days of the internet, everyone on the internet was cool and you could like trust what they said and there weren't so many bad actors. There were spammers and things like that, but it was pretty obvious what a spam email was. Whereas, you know, in a year or two, you're going to have no way to know unless you have some kind of digital ID that you're talking even to a real human being, let's say. I mean, unless we'll see how good the AI gets, but it will become a legitimate concern, I think, and we'll need some way. And that's going to include digital ID, not just of us as the humans in the system, but, you know, all the parts of the system too. You know, like, we're streaming right now and there'll be some sort of digital ID saying, you know, a camera made by Samsung recorded this video and then it was sent to StreamYards with this digital ID in order to have a chain of providence, because at any point the AI could have just generated everything in there. So it's really a complicated issue, and I worry as a technologist that none of the technical details are being debated in parliaments, let's say, or, you know, we're just being told this is coming, you're going to eat it, and, you know, who's designing it? With whose interest in mind? And it's certainly not us, the little people. So it kind of behooves us to come up with our own solutions in, you know, there are efforts underway to do that, let's say, but it's important that people in this space that value, you know, their ability to post online their thoughts that would get them in trouble, maybe, you know, they need to be aware of this and what's coming.
So Why don't you sketch that? What do you think is coming, or hypothetically, what could be coming? Is that a space where basically you can't really say much without fear of the law coming down on you? Or is it going to be a space where some people are just instantly disqualified once they've said some particular thing, they've crossed the line, that's it, they're gone? What do you envision here?
I tend to lean on the dead internet theory, and in that, like, you know, sites on the open internet will become, you know, like, I'm not on Facebook anymore, but I understand Facebook is now, you know, old ladies posting photos of their cats and getting lots of thumbs up, you know, like, that will be, there'll be that level of discourse on the open internet or on these big social media platforms. And then there will be, you know, government approved messages. So like the mainstream media, you know, like the mainstream media also has a vested interest in not going extinct. And this is one way that they can fight back as well. They get, you know, the big shiny check mark saying, yes, this is a real source of information. And the governments can keep them to account in one way or the other. And, you know, like the elite structure will, you know, like they will regain some control over the Wild West of the internet. So in response to that, people that have, let's say, more interesting things to say will be forced back underground. And that's, you know, like there's a lot of talk the last few years about, you know, people forming intentional communities. I would say the parallel here would be there would be intentional online communities that form around a certain set of values, that would have their own speech codes, let's say, that would have their own membership requirements, trust, reputation systems, things like that. And a lot of the interesting things that were happening on the open internet will migrate into these spaces. So, you know, like you can say that that's doom, but, you know, I also like all change is also opportunity. As we move into more private spaces, a lot of the current taboos about what you're, I mean, a lot of the current taboos have already seem to fall away the last year or two. But, you know, once you're in a private space with people that think like you, I mean, okay, you get a bit of an echo chamber, but you'll also really be able to say what you think. And maybe that makes people happier. I don't know. Like, the point is, I think the global village that Marth McLuhan spoke of will fracture back into, you know, I don't know if it'll be on national lines or subnational lines. But the point is, like, the global conversation will disperse again. And there'll be a lot of opportunities for people to build businesses in that space. And, you know, like, that's one thing that I'm trying to do with the Gjallar Project, produce a technical platform for intentional communities to build projects on and to communicate on.
This bifurcation is already happening even with the open internet, because X is basically now, and I can't believe I'm saying it given what Twitter was like just a few years ago, but X is now essentially a right-wing space in which there are some left-wing interlopers, people hanging around, lingerers, but the overall tone is clearly right-wing. I don't know. Maybe if I were to look in, maybe they can still exist there and prosper more than I realize. But certainly my experience of it is that it's largely a right-wing space. And then you've got Blue Sky, where they decamp to. And you hear various things about this, that it lasted a few months and then they collapsed into purity spiraling and tone policing each other. And a lot of them came back to X. But it's still going. And there are millions and millions of users there, and it's absolutely a left-wing space, Blue Sky. So I think you see this already, that the divide between the left and the right, and I know that people will take issue with those labels. I agree, it's not exactly accurate anymore, but whatever. The terms refer to something that is real in the world today. They no longer have much in common at all, or at least these two groups feel like they don't have much in common at all. And there's a lot of loathing between them, especially from the left towards the right. I mean, they seem to think that we're basically evil. So there's not that much commonality anymore. And so there's not much reason or need for us to be in the same space anymore. They've got nothing to say to us except what we believe is drivel. And we've got nothing to say to them except what they believe is evil. So you can see why it would naturally split and we would just go our separate ways as much as we could. And on the internet, that is kind of total. We don't ever need to interact. So that's a sort of beginning of what you're talking about, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you build the Tower of Babel trying to reach heaven, and God knocks it down, and everyone goes back to speaking 1,000 tongues sort of thing. And there's limits to how big and centralized any one thing can get, right? And I think we've discovered some of them, and you're seeing, yeah, that bifurcation along, you know, let's say the left and the right are two camps that have been set up by the elite to battle, you know, like, so that your anger and your energy is directed at someone that's not them, and you're not interfering with their plans, and, you know, you and you fight, and I'll sit here and run the world, sort of thing. So the one last, I think we've basically covered most of what I wanted to talk about that was happening this year, except for one last thing, and it does relate also to what you just mentioned about X being a right-wing space. And you can say that is largely because Elon Musk aligned himself politically with Trump in this election cycle, and therefore, you know, he has a lot of cover to do things with X that he might not have had under a Democratic administration. And so there's another large group that's relevant to the topic of, let's say, online speech or online communities. There's another group that is really aligned with the current Trump administration, and that is the big cryptocurrency companies that are operating out of the US. And they're getting a lot of laws passed this year. So the Genius Act is the main one that is providing a lot of clarification for how stablecoins, so-called stablecoins, are going to work on the internet, what they have to use as reserve assets, what's legal, what isn't legal. And this will be interesting. Also, there's some laws that came in late 2024 in the EU called the EU Travel Rule. I don't know if that's the name of the rule or the law, but that's generally how it's referred to. And basically, this is where all these major cryptocurrency companies are now required to capture the originator and beneficiary of all crypto asset transfers, regardless of size. And if you are self-hosting crypto wallets, they have to do this for all transactions over 1,000 euros. And then there's an explicit provision that privacy preserving coins or anonymous wallets are to be banned by July 2027. Now, what that actually means is they likely can't ban these things entirely, but they can ban you from cashing them out, from connecting them to a bank account. You know, it's going to become something that you can use in the back alley to trade for something else you would get in the back alley, but it's something that, you know, like, you as a content provider aren't going to be able to solicit anonymous cryptocurrency coins. And
it's amazing that this stream ended up happening tonight. because just last night, after I finished last night's streams, I went to my email and I saw for the first time an email saying you have received a Link donation, Chainlink, which is a crypto coin, and it won't be processed until you provide full details of the person who sent it. And so I don't know the person.
You don't even know, right?
I have no idea who it was. So yeah, exactly. But the interesting thing is, it's not for €1,000. It's for about €200. 190 pounds. So I'm guessing that's about €220. Mm-hmm. £190. And so someone made a big donation. That's the biggest donation I've received so far this millennial. And I can't get it.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't get it because of the EU travel rule. It specifically said it was the EU travel rule. Exactly. So I've got to, if the person who kindly made that donation wouldn't mind emailing me with their details, then I can get this this link. But otherwise, and I don't expect that they will want to do that, I can't. So thank you EU. You know, it's amazing that you get this experience. It was the same a few weeks ago with when I first saw one of my essays going behind the age wall, the age verification barrier. You get this sense of, oh, fuck, the government really is powerful. You know, and by that, I also include the EU and these other globalist bodies. You realize it's not just talk, you know, that they can actually stop me doing things or stop other people doing things for me, helping me, donating. As I say, it's that's the first time it's happened. I'm not quite sure. I don't know if it was because of the size of the donation, and I don't know whether it was because of the platform that I was that I've got that wallet on. I don't know, but it is a real thing, and it's just getting in the way. So now that's yet another way that I now can't fund myself and what I do. It's difficult to feel that this is anything but oppression.
Yeah, and I mean, that was sort of the third leg that they were kicking out of underneath people in the 2017-2018 purges was, okay, maybe we don't ban you, but we demonetize you. And on, as I was saying earlier about how the culture of the internet is that everyone expects essentially things for free, because there isn't much culture of paying for our content in one way or the other. The monetization through advertising became very critical for content creators, and okay, now even their alternative method of collecting funds, you know, like we got to go back to sending money orders in the mail, essentially. And, you know, they're trying to outlaw cash. So I don't think money orders are far behind. So, yeah, what can I say?
Yeah,
we were promised
every base.
Yeah, like we had to wait a little bit for regulators to catch up with some of these technologies. But like, what I would say is, yeah, the fun times that started, let's say, in 2015 in the run-up of Trump, where we thought we were winning online, that door is closing. Maybe it took 10 years to write all the laws and get to put the screws to all the companies, but, you know, we need to consider the opportunities of how we move past, like, that is what the world we live in is like. And so I can maybe transition now a little bit to my project, and you know,
yeah,
the
please
sorts
do.
Of things
I think
now in the future.
We need some upbeat material now. So,
let me get festive then. Yeah,
I think we've outlined that the current situation isn't great. So, let's now talk about Hjallar, which is a Beowulf project, and please take it away.
Sure. So, bad things are out there on the internet, and they make you sad, and you your pseudonymous or your anonymous contents is becoming more difficult for you to post. So what can you do about this situation? Well, largely, I think it's going to look like a reversion to things that were common back in the early internet. You'll have to be registering your own domain name. Now, registering a domain name is not a private process. You have to give contact details and addresses and things like that to the agency that you register with. But once you do that, domain names actually have pretty strong property-like protections, let's say. So domain name registers aren't allowed to just seize them. They need at least like court orders to seize them. And I mean, court orders to seize them are possible, but you see that, you know, like, let's put it this way. If a million Anons register a million domain names to speak on, well, that's a million court orders that the courts have to process in order to seize them or ban them and all like that. So in some sense, moving off the centralized platforms will make enforcement of this regime more tedious for the elites, but I mean, they can change the rules of the game at any time. So this is, let's say, a short-term step. So what do you do with that domain name? Typically, and this is putting back on my 2002 web hosting provider hat, typically you would point this at a server that you rent or a server managed by someone else that you pay a monthly fee, or what becomes more feasible now that more and more people have, let's say, fiber connected internet to the home, is you could run a server in your closet and point your domain name at that. And so now that's at least a box that you or someone that you have a direct business relationship controls. And so that's the layer that I'm trying to attack with Hyaller. So we have a number of servers located in a number of countries on a number of hosting providers that we use to host the Beowulf Foundation's projects, data. We have collaboration tools. We run a Matrix server, which is, if you're not familiar, Matrix is like a do-it-yourself Discord, essentially, a self-hosted Discord. And what is out there and what has active communities developing it are a number of pieces of software that you can run yourself or you can pay someone to run on your behalf that provide everything that the big tech giants do. And so the challenge becomes now, how do we make it simple enough for people that wish to migrate off the big tech giants, make it simple enough for them to do that? How to make it secure? And also, part of what we're working on with Hyaller is to provide a layer of deplatforming resistance. So how does that work? Now, everyone, I think, in your audience is familiar with how a VPN works. You connect your server, or your computer connects to a server somewhere in a target company or target country and forwards traffic on for you. So with what we're doing with Hyaller is sort of the reverse. The website that you're hitting is going through essentially a VPN. We have a pool of ingress servers, and those servers are located in various countries around the world. And then the idea is, if a deplatforming request is made to whoever hosts that server, we just take it out of the pool and the next one spins up. And, you know, now millennialwoes.com, you know, 5 seconds ago appeared to be served out of the UK. Now it's served out of Germany. Now it's served out of the United States. Now it's served out of wherever. And while this isn't, you know, foolproof, it would turn a deplatforming request from something where I just send in, you know, like one email goes to one provider and boom, a website's down, at least it would become something that's multi-jurisdictional now, because the physical server that hosts the website could be in country A, the ingress server that it serves on can be in country B, and those can change rapidly as well. So the system is structured like a private cloud, and everything is redundant in order that systems and data can be migrated internationally with relatively small downtime. If, like, let's say somebody seizes one of my servers, or somebody DDoSs someone. And so it's been a challenge to, so that the biggest challenge of building a system like this is that performance suffers. There's multiple hops across the internet now to service web page requests, but it can be managed, it turns out. And almost all of the Beowulf Foundation's projects and websites have been running on this system for a year and a half, 2 years. And what the project now is about how this can be opened up to a larger audience, people outside the Beowulf Foundation that, you know, want a friendly place to host various services, whether it's, you know, private discussion forums for your private group, or whether it, you know, eventually the hope is to scale this up to being able to offer video hosting services, video streaming services, things like that. And that would then look, I'll finish that topic and maybe let you respond, and then kind of I've got the federation aspects that I can talk about next.
Well, it sounds like you're trying to build resistance and resilience against the standard methods of censorship. And I think it's high time that we did something like this. I can remember people talking about this in 2017 when the censorship first started, and that was right after Charlottesville, so August 2017. Milo had been banned from Twitter a year earlier. I think that was September 2016. It was just before Trump got elected, oddly enough. And so then after Charlottesville, there was a wave of bannings on YouTube, and that's when the whole thing happened with the Daily Stormer, that their domain name being seized by one company said that they wouldn't be the registrar for that domain anymore. So they moved it to Google as a domain registrar, and Google just seized it, which is amazing. And that was the first, I mean, it was awful that would happen to anyone, but just in the name, for the sake of free speech. But it was also scary that there was nothing that could be done about that. Google apparently had the legal right to do that, or if they didn't, you would need an absolute fortune to take them to court to get your domain name back. So they were able to just take a website offline in that way. So that domain name no longer worked, and as far as I know, it hasn't worked ever since. So then that website had to go by many other domain names, each one of which got cancelled in short order. So that was how that particular website was attacked and undermined continually, so that its user base, its visitor base would diminish more and more and more, sort of starve it of users. And the malice there, the sort of driving purpose is alarming. It was like a sort of holy mission to stop this website from flourishing. And again, it doesn't matter what you think about the Daily Stormer or the content on there. This is a matter of principle. And because after all, it can be the same thing can happen to any website. And so in that environment, that all these YouTube channels being shut down for the first time, that happened in right after Charlottesville. In that environment, people started to think, well, what is going to be necessary? If they can do this to us and they can cut off our funding and all the rest of it. And the payment process, if a payment processor bans you, then you have to move to a different one, but then they might ban you. And there aren't that many payment processors. It could easily become just made impossible for you to make a living from doing this, or it could be made impossible for you to get your work to the public. And it was shortly after that that I got banned from PayPal, actually, in January 2018. But the point is that at that time, people started talking about building an entire system. So a domain registrar, a service provider, a payment processor, and even a bank. And sadly, 7 years later, none of that has materialized. I think because of the sheer amount of money that's involved in setting up a bank, apart from anything else, and then the monopoly that huge companies have on the sector of payment processing, for example. I don't know how you would even get that set up if you wanted to become a new payment processor. I think that would be a massive undertaking. And I keep hoping that Elon Musk will do that because he talks about freedom of speech and so on. But he doesn't seem to have much interest in that. So that was talked about. It's been talked about for a long time. And that was the first time I saw it. I dare say that there were people thinking about it hypothetically long before then as well. So there has been a need for this. Okay. Obviously, looking forwards from here, I don't know. And again, I'm remembering the words of Cameron McGregor from last night. I don't know for how long they can keep a hold on this kind of stuff and how long they can keep insisting on these laws and these provisions. But nonetheless, it could be for a long time. So I think it's good that something like Hjalur is being developed.
Yeah, I mean, as for how long this can go on, I mean, they can starve you a lot faster than they themselves will starve. So I think the strategy will have to become, you know, flow like water. And that's what I'm trying to do with Hjalur. Like, if the laws of country X are unacceptable for you to say what you say, then, you know, you need to host in country Y and like, but be ready to jump at a moment's notice, things like that. And it's you know, like, I'm not a huge Alex Jones fan, but this is going to become InfoWars, you know, like the world is a battle space. The entire economy in fifth generation warfare is a battle space. And so, you know, like us chumps, us little guys have just wandered into it, and the big guys are rumbling there as well. And you have to be ready not to go toe to toe with them, but be ready to step around their footsteps, let's say. And so part of doing that is to try to move away from these large platforms and not just, you know, like go from a YouTube to a Rumble. Like, Rumble seems to be a perfectly legitimate business, but not legitimate. Makes it sound bad. Seems to be a perfectly acceptable business, but it's just another YouTube that has, you know, like, it's controlled by a different guy, but it can do all the same things that to deplatform you or demonetize you that any other one can. And that's not to single out Rumble. Like, Substack is a very, you know, good company as well, but it's also a centralized platform that, you know, like, you can point your own domain name at it. And I think they've done a lot of good work making a good user experience for people to be able to publish things, and their you know, their tolerance for dissident thought or heterodox thought seems to be pretty good. But, you know, that can change when the company changes ownership or somebody sits on them from above. And the reality is, like, we need federated systems where you ultimately are publishing yourself online, and then the trick becomes, okay, how does anyone discover your content? How do people share it? How do people recommend to each other? And there's been a lot of work that's been going on in the past few years, especially a protocol called ActivityPub has recently been, I don't know if it was a year or two or three ago, become like a W3C web standard. And it's been implemented by a lot of alternative, you know, like there's the Mastodon network, which is sort of an alternative microblogging federated system, or it's been adopted by PeerTube, which is basically what I'm talking about for YouTube. You know, you post your own YouTube video on your own server and it can be shared to other people. And it's just going to be the hard work of trying to coax audiences onto these alternative platforms. But the good news is, I think the establishment is doing a lot of the hard work for us. I mean, I don't know what happened to 16-year-olds or 15-year-olds in Australia last week, whether they were had a pop-up come up saying, well, you're banned from Facebook now or TikTok or whatever, bad luck. You know, a lot of these people are going to migrate off because, you know, like, because they're officially blocked or legally blocked from services. And a lot of people aren't going to want to cough up an ID to continue to post cat memes on Facebook. So we can expect some level of exodus from some of these platforms voluntarily, I think. And people have to be ready with alternatives for those to join. And so all, you know, like content creators in this space need to be thinking about what's their backup plan? Where are they going to redirect their audience to next week, next year? Because, you know, like the landscape's shifting quickly here and we don't know exactly what, you know, like these age verifications are coming into force now and we don't know how exactly they're going to be enforced, because it's kind of been left up to the providers. They're just being told, enforce it or we fine you. So, but at the same time, we have to remember that, like, you know, some ungodly amount of traffic on the internet is just like peer-to-peer BitTorrent movies being shared. Like, they haven't actually... Hollywood was fighting the BitTorrent protocol for a long, long time, but it's still out there and never totally got crushed. I think they tolerate it at this point, partially because they're selling you the same interests, the same special country in the Middle East is largely behind selling you VPNs to go on and cruise the high seas. And so now it's just it's a lower margin revenue stream. We can't sell, you know, we lose a few sales of the latest Cape Shit movie, but at least we collect all your data while you're pirating it. And that's a whole other conversation we could have. But that's
one of the dangers of, I remember people, it's one of the dangers of using a free speech alternative is that it ends up being, that's already been bought. That all along, that was a decoy. It was set up so that people who are into free speech would use it and thus expose themselves to the custodians. I remember when people would talk about DuckDuckGo or Tor even, and then it turned out that it was said, I don't know if it's true, but it was said that each of those was already owned. It was already, and Signal, people would talk about the Signal messaging platform, and then I heard that was also working with the CIA or something. It can, and again, I don't have any of that verified. I'm just saying, even if though it isn't true for those platforms I just mentioned, it could easily be true. It could easily turn out, well, actually, that was just a that was put in front of you so that you would use it and thus expose yourself as a dissident, someone who's into stuff that's non-mainstream. So that's a danger.
Yeah, I mean, a good example, I think an explicit example of this is the Tor project, which I believe was originally, it was founded by NSA or someone else within within the U.S. government. And it was essentially heralded as an anonymous platform that could be used by dissidents in the unfriendly regimes to speak out. So the countries that are cracking down on their political dissidents or their opposition politicians or their minority groups, things like that. The system is set up so that these people can escape censorship controls of their governments. But especially in the cryptocurrency space, a lot of like darknet markets, drug bazaars, things like that operated on the Tor network. And these ones somehow managed to get found and infiltrated and turned into honeypots and things like that. So it's not really, you can't really know for sure, but it's widely suspected that the Tor network is more than 50% run by some aspect of US intelligence. And if you're using that as a means of anonymously communicating, well, they, if they control enough of the network, they can see where everything connects to each other. So maybe they can't read the contents of your message, but they can tell it's you. And I mean, that was a big lesson from the Iraq war, was a lot of intelligence. It was simply enough to see who was talking to who at what time. You don't have to get the contents of encrypted messages to build a pretty good map of what's going on within networks, network mapping. I forget if it was the Snowden leaks or earlier that revealed a lot of the technology behind that. So, I mean, what I'm proposing is also, it's not a panacea against that level of organized opposition. Like, if you're going to draw the eye of Sauron, you shouldn't be on the internet, I think, is the message at the end of the day. Like, but so that needs, that then becomes like the conversation that needs to be had, I think, is okay, like, let's say people that were outside the mainstream had a little bit of fun and a free ride in the days of the early internet, and then let's say in the 2015, you know, rise up to Trump, the meme wars and things like that, Gamergate. The conversation that I don't think anyone's having public, or I mean, not nobody, but the public conversation needs to be like, okay, well, these voices are out there. Do we just crush them? I mean, are these people really just the wreckers that are stopping the utopia from unfolding on Earth? Or does there have to be a way for these people to speak? And I mean, as someone of an Anglo heritage, like, free speech was the solution to this, you know, back in God knows when, you know, was it Magna Carta that gave us free speech? Or, like, this is an old English tradition.
It's something that goes back. Yeah, it's so ingrained that we don't even have it in our laws. It's just, it was something that was absolutely taken for granted up until about 2005, when the 1986 with the Malicious Communications Act, but that didn't really affect much until the mid 2000s, and when it started to become a thing that you could, there was such a thing as hate speech, and there was such a thing as stuff that could get bring legal repercussions upon you. And up until then, it was Americans talk about the First Amendment, but up until then, we didn't even need a First Amendment. It was just absolutely normal and taken for granted that you could say whatever you liked. I mean, not on TV, maybe, but even there, you could say whatever you liked. You just had to say it politely. So it's a huge, profound, and subtle change that's happened. Well, not sometimes not so subtle change that's happened in the British psyche over the last 20, 25 years. I agree. We need to protect it. It's obvious that our governments have absolutely no interest in protecting it. And one thing that occurred to me while you were speaking was, you'll remember the Arab Spring and how Twitter and social media in general was celebrated at that point. I think that was 2010, 2011. Probably that is the background to Sergey Brin's comment at that conference a year or so later. It was celebrated because, well, social media frees people and empowers people and democratizes stuff so that people can actually claim their freedom and take down their government and demand their rights. And at that time, that was seen as a good thing. As I say, I think that Trump and Brexit completely changed that, so that now it becomes a case of protecting at all costs the status quo in the West, in the Western societies. We'll celebrate a Middle Eastern society being taken down, but our own, our democracy is absolutely sacred and must be protected at all costs from these hate mongers, disinfo agents, fake news merchants on the internet.
Yeah, and I mean, that just goes to show that it's really not what is being said, but how it aligns to power. And, you know, if power says that, you know, an Arab Spring is what we want, or if power decides that, then it, of course, will be facilitated. But if power says we don't like the JQ, or we don't like people that want to go live in the woods and not be left alone, or you know, then it can come down on you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
I don't know how best to approach or to tie in this topic, but I would say the last thing that I, like the last general area that I wanted to talk about was also how the development of AI is going to further complicate this matter, I think. And I can make it topical because, you know, like within the past week, the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of, or we've seen announcements or rumors of announcements where various companies are going to be getting out of the consumer electronics space. So they're going to stop making RAM. The RAM prices are getting really expensive. I think it's still only rumor that Samsung is thinking about getting out of the solid state drive commercial or consumer market. And like one lens to put on this is that, you know, power doesn't really want us on the internet anymore. Like, they don't want us having these conversations because there is some threat to, you know, to the status quo. And we will, I think, see this really, really poignantly as AI becomes a bigger part of the economy. Now, there's a lot of people out there, and I tend to agree with them, that AI is kind of in a bubble right now. There's been a lot of overinvestment in, or there's, let's say, there's scheduled investment, there's proposed investment that we need, you know, a billion more data centers, and the data centers are going to use more power than can actually be generated in the US and Europe. And there's big plans in mind for this rollout of AI. But what will be important for those of us that are in these spaces, or, you know, let's say got used to speaking freely online, is a lot of this hardware is not going to be available to us, the little guy. You know, like, you saw that starting during COVID, it became very difficult for gamers to get their GPUs, and the prices started going through the roof and things like that. And I think the reality is that a lot of this technology is going to stop being marketed to us as the consumers, both as we get poorer, as our standards of living decrease, you know, we're not that interesting a market, but also because specifically AI is a very centralizing friendly, the technology really leads well towards centralization. Like, there are open AI models out there. There's a thriving open AI model community, but the real heavy development is happening within the big tech giants. And I think it'll be some time before that work will, you know, spill out. Let's say, you know, they'll always be one or two generations ahead of the open work that's available for you or I to run on a GPU if we can afford it. But a lot of the hardware being designed to run these tasks is specifically, like, you have to sign a partnership agreement with NVIDIA. Who are you? Like, it's not even for sale on the open market. And I think that this, they're treating AI and the hardware to run it as, this has become a new strategic asset, essentially, in the same way that, like, you and I can't buy jet engines or things like that. AI is largely going this way as well. And this is going to further exacerbate some of the power imbalances between those of us that are just trying to speak on the internet, and because they'll be using that AI to monitor you, to look at your history of what you're doing, to monitor your transactions and things like that. And okay, like, I can talk about building federated blogging platforms or sharing videos online, but, you know, I'm not going to be able to deploy thousands of AI agents on your behalf to upvote your posts or things like that. And that will become a big disparity, especially when you tie it into some of the developments in digital ID. So if big corporate or big state actors are in control of all the AI, and they're also the ones that that issue the digital IDs, well, now, you know, millennial woes can have 5,000 downvotes from real validated accounts, because look at what the digital ID says. It checks out good. And it will just be another, you know, another evolution in the war to manufacture consent, to keep us all happy and living in the pod, or whatever the heck the plan is for 2030 these days. So it's kind of a, let's say I'm a pessimist, but I see a lot of opportunities for interesting work in the future. But what that's going to look like, I think, is anyone's guess at this point.
Yeah, it's very difficult to guess where this is going to go. AI is obviously a sort of wild card. It could lead to things that we can't really imagine just now. You say 5,000 downvotes on something I put up, and that kind of thing would be demoralizing. You know, if I put up a Substack essay and I've worked hard on it and I'm proud of it and I'm looking forward to seeing what people say about it and the conversations that it starts, and instead it's 1,000 people saying that I'm just a piece of shit and that I'm illiterate or something, I don't know. That would be quite demoralizing. I mean, it would get to the point where, okay, so, well, there's just no point in me doing this anymore. Because it's just leading to bad emotions, and any sincere human comments in the thread are completely drowned out. So ordinary people can't see the ordinary people anymore. So that would be a way to seriously disrupt the ordinary process of content sharing and content enjoyment. I don't like the word content, but it's useful in this context. So yeah, they could completely disrupt that and shatter the legitimacy of making something and sharing it online. So, and that in turn, I think, would really demoralize people who do that for a living, or even do it for a hobby.
Yeah,
why would you keep doing it?
It's already known that intelligence agencies in various countries run these kinds of operations on social media platforms. My point is just that, like, they'll have a scale, they'll be able to do it on a scale that, you know, like, maybe I'll turn on the internet one day and I'll never be able to interact with another human again, but I'll think I'll be in the perfect walled garden of me versus, you know, 20 AI bots, and that'll be the end. And so that, again, is the argument for building intentional communities. And there has to be some real life component to that as well. Like, communities need to be able to come together, build trust, work on projects, even little things. I mean, you'll see people do this naturally, I think. And this is kind of where I can tie it back to where I started with talking about how my sort of my inspirations were John Michael Greer and his work that built on that of Joseph Tainter. Basically, they talk about civilization ending as a result of over-centralization and the resource requirement for that over-centralization. So, and they've gone back and, you know, looked at many, you know, civilizations that rose and fell in the past. And Greer does a really good job of tying it essentially to, you know, what is the technology stack of that civilization and when does it hit the limits of resources that it can take. So the good I'll sketch the picture for Rome, because that's the one that I can do off the top of my head the easiest. So basically the argument is that Rome was able to expand as it expanded into the territories of its rich neighbors that it was able to conquer militarily, and the resources that it extracts from its neighbors in doing so funds the next round of conquest, the neighbor, the other side, the next way. And so the argument that Greer makes is that essentially Rome expanded to its natural limits. Either it hit barbarian tribes that didn't have a lot of resources to extract, so the Germanics, you could try to conquer them, but they just go hide in the woods and there's nothing good to take from them. Or they hit the Persian Empire and they can actually defend themselves. And so the problem is now you've built this empire, and maintaining the empire was only possible while it was expanding. And so now it has to contract. There aren't enough slaves to work the farms anymore or what have you. And they draw this parallel between the Roman Empire, the Mayan Empire, or the Mayan civilization, various Chinese dynasties. And basically the argument, this is how it came out of the peak oil argument, is we've kind of, Western civilization has hit, I mean, you can argue about what the year is of peak oil, but the point is this centralizing trend of, you know, one world government or something like that depends on rich, dense energy sources to continue to grow. And when it can't continue to grow by taking on more energy input or resource input, it starts being unable to maintain its existing infrastructure. And, you know, this, Greer was writing about this in 2005, before the 2008 bubble. And I mean, what can you say about the infrastructure of the UK since then? The empires are having a hard time, you know, keeping the roads fixed, keeping the bridges. Like, this is how it came to my attention. We were always told in engineering that, you know, the North America has like a 50-year backlog of bridge repairs that need to be done, because we build the bridge, but fixing it doesn't get you any new economic activity. It just keeps the same economic activity occurring. And so basically these guys say, like, well, in the end it all starts tumbling down different steps, and polities start breaking apart into smaller and smaller subdivisions. And so that's what I think is essentially going to happen online. We're going to see these big central platforms break apart into smaller ones and smaller and smaller.
So a sort of disintegration of Western civilization as we know it.
Well, it needn't be. Let's put it this way. So they offer two scenarios when a civilization or an empire hits this kind of point of diminishing returns from expansion. They can either try to transition to a steady state where they don't need to grow. And I think that's the needle that's trying to be threaded right now. So
So they're sort of making peace with not infinite growth.
Exactly, yeah. So the most concrete example of this, I think, has been the proposed implementations of the need to cut CO2, the green movement, let's say. The proposed solutions to this are always something like carbon credit exchange or caps or things like that. And these are essentially all some kind of rationing of energy. And that's why, you know, we the little people can hem and haw. We don't like it. It's too expensive. It's terrible to live, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is, if you can't keep growing the energy resource base that the civilization consumes, then you either have it collapse or you have to get it to steady state. So that means we have to, you know, like we have to ration essentially. And that's, you know, like if you can replace the carbon with solar panels or wind farms or whatever, then oh, okay, great. You can have that energy to use, but we're basically rationing oil now. And that's why these issues don't seem to go away. You know, like there's no, it doesn't matter how much we argue about it. It doesn't matter whether the price of oil goes up or down this week or that week. These plans stay in place because at some level, I think the elite understand that this resource needs to be rationed, if only for their own self-interest. Like we need oil to run the military. So maybe you don't get it for your car anymore. And it's not that it's run out, but we just need that much for the military, you know, like the ever growing needs of the state outweigh your needs.
Yeah. And I think also there's an argument, sort of sci-fi dystopia argument, that it's better for a state to have a miserable, demoralized populace because they'll never rise up. They'll be too exhausted. They'll be too tired, they'll be distracted with short-term interests, and they won't have the resources or the will to rise up. I don't know if that's altogether true. I think that impoverishment and starvation can actually be a great motivator for people to rise up against their state, but who knows? That could go either way. But I think the conclusion to all of this is we should be trying to fortify ourselves against instability, whether that comes from the resource shortages or more likely from tyrannical governments, because they clearly are tyrannical. I mean, they clearly are. They really don't like people speaking freely, and they're very clear about that again and again nowadays. I mean, they speak about free speech as if it's something dirty, when 15 years ago, they were all for it. And it's an amazing, I spoke about the British attitude to freedom of speech, but this is everywhere now. And it's an amazing change that's happened, where now freedom of speech is talked about as if it's something very hazardous and dirty and dangerous and something that only bad people are really interested in. And I find that astonishing. So yeah, we absolutely need to take measures within reason, measures that we can take that don't greatly inconvenience everyone and make it a chore and a nightmare to go online. I think we should. So I think that Kyalr is a very interesting project. Are you looking for people to help with it and get involved or not?
So it's a bit difficult because of the security implications. I can't just take on volunteers and say, okay, here's the servers, have at it, because there's our private data on there. But if you are interested in the projects that I've been talking about, there's things that will be built on top of Kyalr. And what I would say is contact the Beowulf Foundation. That's beowulf.foundation on the web. And there's a vetting process for volunteers, and we always need more developers. even if you don't think you're a good developer, you can do a lot of developing with like a $20 a month Claude Code subscription. Use the AI while you still can, while it's still available to you. And there's also a lot of great opportunities to unify with other people from other perspectives outside just the dissident right or the e-right or whatever you want to call us these days, because there's a lot of people outside our sphere that are also concerned about these issues, and there's a lot of projects underway. So Mastodon is one. Like, you can go join a Mastodon server now and start migrating off Twitter if you felt you needed to, but come to Beowulf Foundation first. We want first crack at you, I think. And at some point, you can become a customer of Hjaller. There was a dream of being ready to begin selling for this stream, but sadly, there's still too much work to do. So we're at Hjaller on X if you'd like to be notified about our specific updates.
That's Hjallr for anyone yes. who's yeah.
That's, so it's old Icelandic for a little platform to dry fish on.
I was going to ask what was the background to the name. What's the word? Etymology. Yeah, etymology. Okay, excellent. I will just say one thing before closing, which is that happened, the thing I was describing earlier with the crypto donation, that happened with a link, chain link donation. It hasn't happened with any other coins. So don't worry about sending me crypto. Just, I think Chainlink is off the menu. I feel it's wise for me to say that. You won't be asked for your full details or anything. With that said, Jack Maninoff, thank you for the work that you're doing. I think it's definitely worthwhile. And good luck with it. And I hope to have you on again so that you can talk about the progress since 2025, maybe in a couple of years' time.
Thank you very much. It was a great privilege to be part of Millennial. I've been a fan for years.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I should say there was a super chat from Dusty who said, thanks for the show. So thank you very much. Okay, with that said, I'll be back in 10 minutes with the next stream. But in the meantime, Jack, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.